is United States of America versus Jose Ramon Guerrezano Rosales. Mr. Cuchera.
May it please the court.
Proceed, please.
Mr. Gay. Your Honor, I'd like to raise and
Mr.
answer.
Mr. Cuchera, let's stop this time. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to go two cases, take a break, and then we'll hear the last two cases if anybody wants to step out at this time or stay if you wish. Go ahead, please.
In our first argument, we argued that the district court did not have jurisdiction or authority to resentence Mr. Guerrezano to 108 months after previously sentencing him to 71. I'd like to raise and attempt to answer four questions with regards to that particular issue. First one is, can United States v. Meza, 620 F3rd at 505, which both parties have cited, be read to stand for the proposition that a sentencing judge can change his or her mind as many times as he or she wants about a defendant's sentence, so long as they do it during the same proceeding on the same day? Second question, can statements made by a defendant during allocution properly be the basis to increase or reduce a sentence that's already been pronounced, orally pronounced? Third question, did the statements made by Mr. Guerrezano during his second exchange with the judge in this case constitute allocution? Fourth, if the statements made by Mr. Guerrezano during his second exchange with the judge were not allocution, were they the sort of statements that would be punishable by contempt?
Get to your most important issues first, okay? Don't go down that order if you don't have to.
Okay. Well, I'll just start. I think that is the right order. The first question has to do with the Meza case. You know, what does it stand for? Does it stand for the proposition that the judge can change his or her mind as many times as they want, so long as they do it the same proceeding the same day? There's certainly language in the opinion that would suggest that. I'm reading from page 508. According to Meza, the district court's initial formulation of the sentence is the type which instantaneously strips the district court of its jurisdiction to sentence criminal defendants and immediately vests such jurisdiction with the court. This court has never adopted such a draconian rule, and we are not persuaded to do so now. Then the court goes on to treat two other cases, and it appears to me that these three cases sort of form the basis for the argument in this case, too. The second one is Ross, United States v. Ross, 557 F3rd 237.
If you have those in your argument, get to the argument. I think that's the most important thing that we want to hear.
Okay. Well, if the case stands for what I've just suggested, then I'm arguing that it's in conflict both with Rule 35. It's also in conflict with two Fifth Circuit precedents. The advisory committee notes to the 1991 amendments to Rule 35 contain this little excerpt. The authority to correct a sentence under this subdivision, back then it was 35C, it's now 35A, is intended to be very narrow and to extend only to those cases in which an obvious error or mistake has occurred in the sentence. That is, errors which would almost certainly result in a remand of the case to the trial court for further action under 35A. And then this is the really important part. This subdivision is not intended to afford the court the opportunity to reconsider the application or interpretation of the sentencing guidelines or for the court simply to change its mind about the appropriateness of the sentence. And
Mr. Cuchera, it seems to me that she did not change her mind in the sense of, you know, well, I think I may have made a mistake, blah, blah, blah. Something happened in this case that made it different. And it seems to me that is your best argument. Okay. And that's what I'm trying to push you to go in that direction
okay.
if possible.
Well, it appears to me that it's beyond dispute that when the judge made this pronouncement, when she said, it is therefore the order and judgment of the court that the defendant, Jose Ramon Guerrezano Rosales, is hereby committed to the custody of the Bureau of Prisons to be imprisoned for a term of 71 months, that constituted an oral pronouncement. And that would be our argument. So the question is, what did happen? Now, at that point, things began to unravel. She asked Mr. Guerrezano, do you understand? If he had responded in Spanish, see, there was an interpreter there. If he had responded in Spanish, see, and said nothing else, he'd have had a 71-month sentence. But he responded in English, and so then she got on to him about the fact that he understood English and had led her to believe otherwise. And then he asked her, why are you giving me so much time? And so then she appeared to get really upset and said, well, you don't like that? I'll give you more. So we're arguing that she did pronounce sentence, and that the fact that it was in the same proceeding on the same day does not make it okay to change your mind. Now, again, that's what that Meza case can be read to stand
for. The implication of what you just said is that the information in the PSI didn't change one iota. It was only the give and take that caused this increase in sentence. And I presume what you're inferring is not only that she could not do that, but that it was vindictive.
I hesitate to
use that word.
To use the word, because I've not been in that position, and maybe I would have felt the same way she felt. It just appears to me that when you orally pronounce a sentence, that you can't arbitrarily change it unless there's clear error. Rule 35A says you can change it within 14 days if there's an arithmetical, a technical, or other clear error.
Right, but if I could just interject, the Rule 35 question is a threshold one. And we do have a sort of continuum, you know, Cross, then Ross, which is much closer in time, Meza smack in the proceeding. I think you have acknowledged that Meza could easily stand for the proposition that this is all one sentencing proceeding. No gavel down yet, not 10 days later. So if we decide that 35 is irrelevant, she's not correcting or amending anything. She's just in the middle of the fray deciding this defendant in front of me is displaying behavior that's disrespectful of the law. If that's true, that is a basis for a 3553 reason, correct? Disrespecting the law. If that were the facts, right? You don't disagree with that?
No, I don't disagree with that.
Okay, and so then the question is, did he display disrespect for the law, or did he display insolence, and was he profane? Was he insulting her personally? And I think your suggestion is that that's the closest it could be, right?
Correct.
It's your attitude. It's what you're wearing. If that's the case, if you're right as to that characterization, what's your best law that says that that would be reversible error, that a judge cannot, angry at a defendant's profanity, give an enhanced sentence?
Well, the cases that I – well, there are some cases – there are – the First Circuit, Second Circuit, and Seventh Circuit have addressed that specific situation. And they – in those cases – and I don't have these in my brief. Perhaps I should cite them on the record. In these cases, the judge changed the sentence after what the defendant said. And in two cases, it was one case was profanity. Another case, it was where an individual just went off and totally preached to the judge and spoke to her very condescendingly, paternalistically, and the judge increased the sentence. So
each time reversed. Well, whatever. Those are cases you haven't cited.
They were not reversed. They were upheld because the judge changed the sentence based on the allocution, and the court said that's okay. What they did called for it. There's the first case is, and I won't, to save time, it's a First Circuit case, 275 F3rd at 23.
You're being candid with the court. You're saying these are affirming the authority of a judge to sentence pursuant to that allocution.
Absolutely.
Okay, now the Rule 32, when it says a defendant has a right to allocute as to any mitigating piece of information, mm-hmm. No one below objected to what she did here and said, you're cutting off my right to argue mitigating. That's not an argument you've made to us, right?
I did make the argument that to object after the 108-month sentence had been imposed would have been suicidal. I did make that argument.
Okay, so that would preserve your right to object, but you haven't said that the error here was denying your client the right to allocute.
No. Okay. You're correct. That's he had the right to allocute, and he did allocute. In fact, the trial judge told him.
I have one hypothetical then. What if a defendant says the victim deserved this? That's his allocution. Can the judge not then say, well, that's a heck of a lot further than not accepting responsibility. Now you're saying they deserved it.
I hadn't anticipated that question, but my first response is certainly that would be grounds to change the sentence. Absolutely.
Okay.
And in some of these cases, this is a case 467 F3rd 1091. It's a Seventh Circuit case. Judge actually changed the sentence to lower than he had previously made it based on the allocution. So, and the last case is 392 F 2nd 214. I won't go into it. But again, certainly allocution could do it. But he had already allocated in this case. After the judge, initially the judge says, do you have anything you want to say? Well, he said that the reason that he had gotten all these arrests back in Virginia and all these problems was because he was Hispanic. And the district judge really reacted strongly to that. And so they got into a little back and forth on that. So finally, she sentences him. And then when he tries to speak again, and by the way, in the initial pronouncement, she says, I've taken into account your allocution. So she, in the 71-month sentence, said, I take into account what you've already said. And that was this little interchange about racism or not racism because he was Hispanic. Then when he began to speak, she says, no, stop. I've already sentenced you. I don't want to hear any more. I heard you during your allocution. So in her mind, he's already allocated. So my argument is whatever he said wasn't allocution. Now, the question is what he said still the sort of thing that he ought to be punished for? I think the answer is no. The case that speaks to this, and it's not in my brief, it's a Supreme Court case. It's In re Little 404 U.S. 553. It's a 1972 case. Basic facts are petitioner showed up, wanted to file a motion for continuance to get another trial counsel, and the court said no. So without benefit of counsel, the petitioner attempted to defend himself. In summation, following the close of the evidence, petitioner made statements that the court was biased and had prejudged the case and that the petitioner was a political prisoner. Okay, and the trial judge adjudged the petitioner in contempt for these statements. Court's order recites that the court at this point informed the petitioner that he was in contempt, as the court felt these remarks were very disrespectful. And that's the exact words that the district judge used in this case. You're being disrespectful to me. The Supreme Court says, we hold that in the context of this case, petitioner's statements and summation did not constitute criminal contempt. There is no indication, and the state does not argue, that petitioner's statements were uttered in a boisterous tone or in any way actually disrupted the court proceeding. Therefore, the vehemence of the language used is not alone enough to measure the power to punish. And I won't read the rest of that in the interest of time. But since the court has not read the record, again, his demeanor obviously doesn't show up in the record. But there's certainly no indication that he made any kind of obscene gestures or that he was, you know, out of control or anything like that. His final statements, he asks her, they have this little thing about, she says, oh, do you do speak English, huh? And so he tells her he likes to listen his own language, and she says, that's fine. Then she says, I don't want to hear any more out of you, because apparently he tried to say something. He asks, why are you giving me so much time? Court, because I think that's appropriate in your case, Mr. Garazano. He says, no. She says, I think you're a liar. I think you have a horrible attitude. And he says, I haven't done. And then she goes in, and she says, I'm going to change it. And he says, I'm sorry. And then he says, I'm not disrespecting. She says, I find you're disrespecting me. And then she says, your sentence has changed from 71 to 108 months. Would you like to keep working up? He says, no. Then I suggest you learn to be more respectful. That's what the court said. That's all he said, at least on the paper. That's all he said. So I don't think the comments he made rise anywhere near the level of what went on in this Supreme Court case wherein the court held it's not contempt. So if it's not contempt, and it's not allocution, and it's pretty mild, then, you know, my argument is there's no basis under Rule 35, and I'm not suggesting, I mean, the parties, and this court is certainly not bound by argument, but the parties seem to agree that Rule 35A, if there's a basis for doing it, that's it. But there's no reason for it. And again, you know, I hate to use the word vindictive because You know, I've been doing this for 16 years, and there are difficult people, and I don't see how judges keep the cool they do sometimes. So I hate to say that, but it just looks to me like on this occasion, the judge lost her composure and arbitrarily increased the sentence.
What is your argument with regards to would you like to keep working up? What's the implication of that statement?
Well, to me, it's keep your mouth shut. That's the way I would take it. I mean, I would think you say nothing. If you open your mouth, anything you say at that point can go from 108 to whenever, wherever. I mean, when I first read it, that's the way I took it. You don't say another word. And I see that I'm out of time.
Thank you, Mr. Couture. Mr. Gay.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'd like to begin by addressing Judge Higginson's hypothetical. In this case, I think it's very clear that what Judge Moses was referring to was being disrespected by the fact that she found his allocution untruthful. That was the disrespecting event. Specifically, she says, "But all that stuff you told me about not understanding the language real well wasn't very true either during your allocution." That's on page 29 of the sentencing transcript. And that's when she discovers that all of his attempts to mitigate his previous criminal conduct by saying that he was being picked on because he was Hispanic in Virginia and having language difficulties, that in fact he admits to her at the very end, "Oh yeah, I speak English, I understand perfectly."
But Mr. Gay, she says, you know, after she imposes the 108 month, she says the circumstances have changed based on your attitude, your lack of respect, your demeanor, and your failure to understand the laws of the United States. Now, obviously, having done that in that particular court for a period of time, I know the numbers and I know the stress that is put on judges. All that said, sometimes you lose your cool and perhaps you shouldn't. And the question is, why under this record shouldn't we just send this back for resentencing?
Well, in Mesa they talk about...
In other words, there's the PSI has not changed, not one iota.
Correct.
Now, there is this attitude change, perhaps, that occurred at the sentencing. With that as a background, what do you say? What is fair and legal in this case?
In Mesa, they talk about a totality of the circumstances approach to looking at whether you had a termination of the original proceeding and a convening of a second sentencing. And here, you can tell from the give and take from the very beginning of this hearing that this defendant was constantly trying to mitigate his own behavior by saying that he was being picked on, that it was essentially racism, that he didn't do all of these things. And she pointed out, and the pre-sentence report reflects, a lengthy history of very serious criminal activity, some of which was never adjudicated in the sense that we don't know what happened in those cases. And she goes through and she recounts to him what those were, and he persists with this view that he actually is sort of an innocent bystander and he's constantly being picked up and he has no culpability. And when she finds out that he in fact has been essentially lying to her, she refers to him as a liar. To him.
Right, I think I do see that, and I got out of your brief that you said really what's going on here is a lack of contrition, which I think
that's absolutely correct.
But then you're also saying it's lying.
His allocution was untruthful in her mind.
Okay, but the challenge for me is if I'm not wrong, the government asked for, and this guy got, 3 points for acceptance of responsibility. I could have seen her stop the whole train and say, you know, those 3 points, if what you're doing is denying what you've done or obfuscating or lying, then you're going to lose the 3 points. But she doesn't do that. She tags on 3 years, right? It's 3 years.
It went from 71 to 108, yes.
So it's a giant jump. And mm-hmm. And usually, what? Therefore, I think, you know, if you look at it from sort of our standpoint of giving some appellate review to this, there are a lot of other statements made. Your words are disrespectful. Everything about you has been disrespectful. That doesn't really connect to anything that we would be able to review under Gaul. That begins to be, you're an insolent person.
I take it back to the fact that the insolence is the fact that she finds that he has been misleading her. And I would.
But what about the acceptance of responsibility? Why not just take that away? The guy's getting the most you could possibly get for accepting.
And what happened was, up until that point, he had acceptance of responsibility.
But she would have authority under our, you know, your statement that she could take that away. She didn't.
I believe that if someone is untruthful during their allocution, and I think that there was
some agreement. But what about when you have multiple factors? Untruthfulness is one valid one, but when we have mixed in here, I don't like what your words are, I don't like anything about you, I don't like your attitude, then you begin to bleed into things that would not be a basis for an upward departure.
And that goes back to my totality of the circumstances argument, that we have to look at everything in context and not in isolation. And here, if you look at her statement of reasons.
We have a case that says the totality approach will allow us to affirm even if there's a reason given that is not a valid one.
I believe that under pre-guideline, pre-Booker practice, that was certainly the case. And I think post-Booker, under 3553, the court is able to consider all of those factors. I'm not arguing that the exact statement that you're referring to. She says a few things that I believe could be construed as non-3553 factors, clearly. But in this case, I think those statements, went with the gloss of what preceded them, makes them have a context which refers, she's not just picking on him because she doesn't like what he's wearing. And in her statement of reasons, she specifically says that the sentence is outside of the guideline range to promote respect for the law and to afford adequate deterrence to the criminal conduct. And that's in the statement of reasons that were entered in this case.
What about other circuits that would deal with all of this stuff that's not related to the law and the offense conduct, but seems to be a chemistry problem with the judge? What about those that say this should be dealt with through Rule 42, contempt?
If that is what it is, if this is a chemistry problem, I have no disagreement with those cases. What I believe this
then,
is...
Then, in other words, this should have been handled with contempt, go to another judge, maximum whatever, six months.
If that's what it was. Yeah. But the way I read this record is that actually she specifically says... it wasn't, and this precedes the allocution where she finds it untruthful, precedes what followed. And so he says, why are you giving me so much time? And she says, because I think it's appropriate. And he says, no. And she says, well, I think you're a liar. You have a horrible attitude. She's basically saying everything that you've been telling me the whole time up here has been fictitious, and you've been essentially, as you point out, not accepting responsibility. Truly, he sort of cratered in that respect. And so I think in the moment, obviously, there was some rhetorically excessive remarks, perhaps, that could have been more succinct. But I think that it's unfair to look at those remarks that followed without giving significant weight to the fact that she really does, and what started this chain of events off, is his whole story was all of this criminal activity, all of this time I'm getting, it was because I was being picked on.
It's harder to look at a totality when her language, inadvertently or not, keeps saying, here's a bright line, well, I sentenced you, and now everything's changed. So she almost disallows a totality viewpoint by saying, I am specifically going 3 years up because of your attitude problem. Then it's harder to say we can just blur it.
And I definitely think that's what this court is going to have to reconcile with Mesa, because Mesa basically, I think, is on point. And that is that we had no gaveling or termination of this proceeding, no reconvening. And so when the circumstances that changed in this case are the fact that his allocution that he had spent was demonstrated to be really a lie. And everything that flowed after that, that was the triggering event.
But what exactly is the lie, that he doesn't speak English? What's the lie in
the lie is that I should not get this much time because my criminal history is improperly overstated because I was being picked on. I didn't do all those things.
He said all that when she gave the original sentence. He never goes back to that. That but, I was, you know...
No, he doesn't go back, but at this point...
So what's the lie that she says he did? I thought he really just said, why so much?
Well, preceding that, though, that actually, that comes afterwards. But preceding that, He says, so she says, so you do speak English? He says, yes. So all that stuff earlier in your allocution that you didn't know the language just doesn't quite work. He says, I like it better. She says, well, that's fine. He says, I want to listen to it in my own language. No problem. That's fine. But all that stuff you told me about not understanding the language real well wasn't very true either during your allocution. And so that is what it comes down to in my view of this record, is that she found that all of his attempts to mitigate his behavior were based upon the fact that he shouldn't be held culpable because he was being picked on because he was.
Do we have any authority that when you have a circumstance like this where really you almost had to have been there to actually understand what that give and take. It has a lot of interpretations in the Cole record. Whether or not a court of appeals can overrule a district judge where there is more than one interpretation to what occurred. You know, my problem is that this is a Cole record. I mean, and I could see how she could have, and I use the word being vindictive for what he was saying at that time, or just simply sentence him to a greater sentence because he was, in fact, not only lying, but lying to her at sentencing. Mm-hmm. Do we have any authority on that, whether a Cole record or whether we even have an authority to reverse this?
I would argue that under Gall, the Supreme Court's opinion in Gall, which this is a non-guideline sentence at this point because of the enumerated 3553 factors. And Gall specifically said that this court, that meaning the circuit court, should not be second-guessing the district court's decisions unless there is obvious error that would require, in other words, the fact that you might view the circumstances differently would not be enough of a reason to change the result in the district court. And what we have here is a record, and as you mentioned, in all cases where we're not there to see the demeanor and all of the various things that aren't transcribed, I think the district courts are accorded considerable deference to make those sorts of decisions. This court is tasked with a situation where you have a chronology of statements, and I direct you to look at the order, and I seriously believe that from the time this hearing began, he was minimizing his culpability, and then not understanding why, in his own mind, he's getting all this time. And then it turns out that much of the basis for his whole allocution was premised upon this idea that, well, because of the language difficulties, and he does reference them, I'm being picked on in Virginia. And she finds that to be quite incredible as a general rule, because the fact is he's committed and been convicted of a variety of serious crimes and many others that we had no disposition on, and she references those as well. And I think up until the point when she found the allocution was untruthful, that was the sentence he was going to get. But once she had an affirmative reason to believe that everything that had preceded really was not truthful and was not really honest, and that's what launched what followed. And so I believe that this court should look at this in the circumstances in which these comments were made. And certainly some of the comments, I'm not suggesting, would fit under Rule 3553. But in the context in which they made, they definitely go to the notion that he does not accept responsibility, he has minimized his conduct, and that she thinks that this sentence is the appropriate sentence to reflect respect for the law and to protect citizens from his longstanding history of criminal behavior.
It is a significant, I mean, it's a situation that can recur a lot. I was a little surprised there isn't more law in the circuits. Basically, any time a defendant feels that a judge goes high, there could be an outburst. Mm-hmm. And you don't run into any of the Rule 35, 32 complications of this case if judges deal with that, an outburst, with contempt, mm-hmm. summary contempt, although that's a burdensome mechanism and it requires much more objectivity, it would immediately separate him from the judge, which could be good. So I'm worried about us saying, well, you can just enhance right away. If his effort to mitigate suddenly enrages you, you can go higher and much higher.
And
because the contempt mechanism protects both parties from that type of meltdown.
The heat of the moment. I think that, and that's exactly what I think is the distinguishing factor in this case, which will make it not stand for that precedent. And that is the fact that I think it would be perfectly solid for this court to say that should the court find that the allocution was untruthful, that is a reason to change the initial formulation. And I use formulation of the sentence because I think it's better for me. But in the proceeding, so if
you... Yeah, I'm just going to, you know, and you know the language better than we do, and it's been quoted back to you. The trouble with finding what the three-year enhancement based on untruthfulness is, her exact quote is, since I've sentenced you, the circumstances have changed. She doesn't say because you're a liar or you're diminishing. She says because of your attitude, your lack of respect, your demeanor, your failure to understand the laws. I find you're disrespecting me. I stand for the law. Your demeanor is your words are disrespectful. Everything about you is disrespectful. In that colloquy, she never comes back to, and I think you lied about your role in this offense.
Yes, and that obviously follows that previous
part.
It
does follow.
It follows. And because she says, I think you're a liar. I think you have a horrible attitude. And that immediately follows where she engaged in the colloquy about the fact that he had been untruthful. And so that, I think, is the distinguishing factor. Absent the finding that he was untruthful and that he had been misleading her, I certainly agree that at that point, I think that outburst of mere profanity or dissatisfaction with the sentence and all of those things would clearly be better dealt with through the contempt mechanism, as opposed to a situation where here there is something in the record that gives it context so that those other remarks, I think, should not be read in isolation.
Last question for me. You don't see my concern about this burdening the mandatory right that a judge elicit any information that the defendant thinks is mitigating. And your opposing counsel, you know, credibly said that isn't our argument here. But we've been really strict, reversed and remanded, when district judges in any way deny a defendant a right to offer any information in mitigation. That's the rule language. I have a hard time not seeing what she did here as something that really burdened that right, because the more he spoke, the more she said, you want me to go higher?
Well, my response is that I think truthful allocution, as opposed to misleading, diminishing, and attempting to escape culpability and recognize what it is that you have in fact done is different than, and so I don't believe that he's being held responsible for what he's saying as much as the fact that, well, that it's untruthful. And that's where I think the difference lies.
Anything else, Mr. Gay?
I'll yield back the balance of my time.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Mr. Couture.
A brief response. The government appears to be arguing that this situation about whether or not Mr. Garzano was lying somehow became more clear to the judge after imposing the 71-month sentence. This is on page 16 of my brief. I'm just going to read a little bit. This is what she had already said at the time she imposed the 71-month sentence. She commented repeatedly about his arrest that didn't result in conviction. She'd accused him of lying and blame-shifting when he attributed his prior interactions with the Virginia criminal justice system to him being Hispanic. She had noted that he was a habitual marijuana smoker, and she had stated that there was a need to, quote, keep somebody who was previously charged with forcible rape out of society. So at the time she imposed a 71-month sentence, she'd already said that. And with regards to whether or not he accepted responsibility, immediately before she imposed, and this is on page 158 of the record, immediately before she imposed the initial 71-month sentence, she says, tell me right now, Mr. Garzano, because I don't want any other judge to hear it anywhere else. Are you guilty of this charge, yes or no? Here's his response. Of the charge of crossing the border. Okay? So that's what he was charged with. He did admit that that's what he did. Now, whether he, you know, admitted his guilt as to all this other stuff, none of which resulted in a conviction, I don't, my understanding of Fifth Circuit law would be that that's not grounds to withhold acceptance of responsibility. A question about the cold record, because we can't really observe his demeanor. We weren't there. In the context of criminal contempt, it requires the district judge to make some objective findings. There is a case where contempt was held, where the defendant, you know, made an obscene obscene gesture. And so the record states that. If there was body language of any type that she found offensive, well, she could have said that. But the record doesn't contain any of that. I can't find a place in the record. I'm not telling you that it's not there, but I can't find a place where he ever said during the proceeding, because they had an interpreter, that he couldn't understand, that he had trouble understanding English. I can't find it. Okay. The government says that Meza is right on point because it all took place in the same proceeding. I think Meza's on point for a different reason. In Meza, the defense attorney pointed out a clear error. The initial sentence was, the defendant was going to be sentenced on two deals. One was two matters. One was a new conviction, the other was a revocation. He gave him 33 months on the conviction, and he stacked 10 months for the revocation. Defense attorney speaks up, "Your Honor, they've changed the initial guideline calculation. It's now 30 months, not 33. Judge acknowledges the error. So I would say that's a clear error. Defense counsel points out a clear error. That gives the judge all the reason in the world to change the sentence. Now, he still gave him 43 months, but then he gave him 33 and stacked 13 on it. So that's, to me, the most distinguishing, important factor about Meza. It's not the time. It's not the timeline. It's that a clear error was pointed out. There's another case. It's a Delgado, and I don't have the site. But basically, the district judge sentenced the defendant in the morning. After he sentenced him, the parties realized they didn't give him a chance to allocute. So later in the day, they bring him back, and the judge gives him the opportunity to allocute, gives him the same sentence. Again, the point is not that it's not the timeline. It's that they realized that there was a clear error there, and so they reconvened to fix the error. We don't have a procedural error here, at least not that I can tell. Now, I've certainly argued that the sentence, even the 71-month sentence, was substantively unreasonable because she relied on his arrest. But, I mean, as near as I can tell, the guidelines were properly calculated. We don't have a clear error here that would have justified her going back to fix anything. So those are some of my responses. Unless there's some questions, I'll give up the rest of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Kachara. Mr. Kachara, before you leave, you're court appointed, and the court wants to thank you for your service to your client. Without individuals like you to serve individuals like the defendant in this case, there'd be a big hole in the judicial system. And because of people like you, that hole is filled, and you've done a wonderful job for your client. And with the court's thanks, you're both excused.
Thank you.